Our next author continues our theme with a litany of leaders, prime ministers from Walpole to May, a maypole dance through history, and you readers will delve and discover revelations of number 10 and earlier than that, a pageant of men and women. Let us not forget Margaret Thatcher and Mother Teresa. His chronicler's beam shines like a laser. He has written of Boris Johnson, not written of as yet, but I digress and I must get to the point. I hear a voice. Introduce him, son. Son? Welcome our author, Andrew Jimson.
Barry and Harry, thank you very much indeed. It's a great honour to be here. My neighbour asked me if I've ever spoken to such a large audience, and it's true that I haven't very often. But Harold Macmillan, Prime Minister, in September 1960 in New York, he was addressing a very large audience at the General Assembly of the United Nations. And while he was speaking on nuclear arms control, which was a terribly important and solemn thing because lots of people thought the end of the world was nigh and that there might be a third world war at any moment. So there was Macmillan speaking about this, and the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, started heckling, and then he started banging on the desk with his shoe. And Macmillan just said, "Well, I'd like it translated, if you would." And Khrushchev was buried beneath a... It's well worth watching on YouTube, actually, buried beneath a roar of laughter from this very solemn audience. Macmillan at that point was still in a sort of super Mac phase. He'd won a great election victory. He himself would soon become the butt of Peter Cook and everyone else. But at that point, he couldn't put a foot wrong, and he dealt with Khrushchev in 8 words, just as a sort of aside, the perfect way, the perfect put-down, and possible because Macmillan was a very, among other things, a very witty man. And you may say that few, if any, of our prime ministers since he stood down in 1963 have been as witty as that, but I nevertheless think it's actually a great pity that Barry didn't go into politics, not too late, because wit and jokes are a very important part of our political tradition. And there's a certain kind of very serious commentator who thinks that all politics has to be done in a serious tone of voice and enormously objects to someone like Trump or our own domestic version of Trump because they won't do this. Ha, yes, who's that? I think actually Boris has been condemned. I mean, it's a kind of compliment. More people have written more serious articles. More good writers, very good writers, have written serious articles condemning Boris than any other figure of the modern political scene. But jokes matter in politics, and of course they can be jokes at the expense of the politician or jokes told by the politician, but great politicians usually have a very... I mean, I discovered this by writing these brief lives of all 54 prime ministers. Most of the good ones have enjoyed doing it, I mean, until it all went wrong, and obviously it does go wrong for everyone, but they've also been able to use wit as one of their weapons to assert their personality. And a very good example of this is Lord North, who is, if he's remembered at all, it's for losing the American colonies, and everyone says the worst prime minister since Lord North when they want to be nasty about whoever the present prime minister is. Lord North actually was a rather brilliant politician. He was prime minister for 12 years, from 1770 to 1782, and he was fantastically good at managing the House of Commons, and also, even more unusually, I mean, those are quite sort of run-of-the-mill qualities for a successful politician, he was a very nice man, which is a bold claim, but I shall illustrate it by a story of Lord North as Prime Minister, who was at the opera one evening, and someone who wanted to sort of get to know Lord North said, "Who is that very disagreeable-looking lady in that box over there?" And Lord North said, "Well, as a matter of fact, that's my wife." And so this sort of intrusive character tried to recover. He said, "No, I didn't mean her. I meant the absolute horror sitting next to her." And Lord North said, "Well, actually, that's my daughter. And we are generally acknowledged to be 3 of the ugliest people in London." And when he was in the House of Commons, he would often close his eyes and appear to be asleep, partly in order to avoid sort of engaging with whatever argument was being made against him. But one day, a very angry speaker from the other side was assailing Lord North and accused him of having gone to sleep. And Lord North, he didn't open his eyes. He just said in quite a loud voice, "Would to God I had." On another occasion, he actually had gone to sleep. And his neighbor nudged him and woke him up. And the Lord Grenville, not Lord Grenville, George Grenville, was talking about what had happened in 1689, the Glorious Revolution. And Lord North just said in a loud voice, "You awaked me 100 years too soon." And again, the house was with him and not with his angry opponent. Now, solemn people or serious people will still say that all this joke stuff can be taken too far, and of course it can. Prime ministers need other qualities, but prime ministers can, even in our system. I don't think Donald Trump ever could become prime minister here, because I think other MPs would find him too embarrassing. In a parliamentary system, he would not get half of the House of Commons to support him. So we exclude people like that. We do have still had some very, very strange and implausible prime ministers, and perhaps the most unexpected outsider, the most unexpected person of all to have become prime minister, and to have become one of the great figures, and the only one in whose memory a posthumous cult was set up, which at its height had almost 2 million members, is Benjamin Disraeli. And Disraeli started out in life with some quite serious handicaps if he was going to be a politician. The first thing was that he was born into the Jewish faith, and he was born in 1804. Jews couldn't be MPs, practicing Jews, until 1858. So that alone seemed to rule him out. Luckily for him, the synagogue conferred a high position on his father when Disraeli was 12, when his father didn't want to do it and said, "Oh, no, I'm not going to do that." And so the synagogue tried to levy a large fine on his father. And his father said, "Well, I'm leaving the synagogue." And then a friend said, "Well, you better get your children baptized into the Church of England." So Disraeli, at the age of 12, was baptized as a Christian. But he was very, very proud of his Jewishness. And he said, he was standing against a member of the Duke of Devonshire's family for election. And he said, "I do not admit that my pedigree is in any way inferior to the Cavendishes." He thought that the Jews were natural aristocrats and that he was as grand as anyone. So he was very proud of it. But he made a complete mess of his early life. His father wanted him to be a lawyer. He wanted to be a glamorous sort of figure. He dressed in absurd clothes. He set up a newspaper, which was going to rival the Times, called The Representative. And he also published some pamphlets about South American mining shares, which he said everyone could get very rich by buying these shares. And, of course, the mining companies went bust. They were essentially fraudulent. The newspaper was useless compared to the Times. It also went bust. And Disraeli then tried to recover his situation by writing a novel about the people who had invested in the newspaper, making fun of them all. And it wasn't a very good novel. He was only 22 at the time. So they were very, even his friends, were very, very angry with him. And it seemed he would never get anywhere. His maiden speech when he last got into the House of Commons was howled down. He lied. He gave a direct lie about whether Robert Peel had offered him a job. And you wouldn't have thought that he would become really the most revered figure in the Conservative pantheon, and the person who, quite unlike Gladstone, of whom Disraeli said he has not a single redeeming defect, but quite unlike the noble, and in many ways fascinating, Gladstone, Disraeli knew how to talk to Queen Victoria, and he knew in particular that he must say how wonderful Prince Albert had been. No one else was as impressed by Prince Albert as Victoria had been, the poor grieving widow. And he wrote to her and he said that the prince is the only man Mr. Disraeli has ever come across who realized the ideal. He absolutely laid it on with a trowel. And Queen Victoria, of course, was so fond of Disraeli that when he was dying, she offered to visit him. And this message was brought to Disraeli and he said, "No, it would never do. She'd only ask me to take a message to Albert." So there, his sense of humour had persisted. Even on his deathbed, he had a sense of humour. And even the most serious things he said were all infused with this sort of ironic or comic touch. And the English the voters loved it. And his novels are very enjoyable. I mean, they're sort of trumpery stuff, but they contain absolutely brilliantly amusing passages. Now, it's true that one can think of prime ministers who weren't all that witty. And possibly in modern times, Edward Heath is the one least associated. But even Heath had a sense of humour. Maybe not shown very often, but of course, after he'd been overthrown by Margaret Thatcher, he was very, very sulky about it all and very cross for many years. Until 1990, when at the end of 1990, she was overthrown. And a journalist asked Edward Heath, he said, "Is it true that you said rejoice, rejoice, rejoice on hearing this news?" Which was what she'd said when British forces had recaptured South Georgia from the Argentines. And Heath, in a very solemn tone, said, "No. What I said was rejoice, rejoice, rejoice." So that was Heath's idea of a joke. I think it's quite a good joke, actually. Not up to Barry's standards, but, you know. As far as I know, he never told a parrot joke, but... My last and very brief anecdote shows that I think a sense of humour also is a good thing because it helps the Prime Minister to keep a sort of sense of proportion. It can help you to stay relatively modest, I think. And I think that's people who don't enjoy it and who don't make much in the way of jokes on the whole are worse Prime Ministers for it. But Alec Douglas Hume, he, of course, had only been Prime Minister from 1963 to 64, when he lost very narrowly to Harold Wilson. He thought that if Enoch Powell and Ian MacLeod had pulled their weight, he might have won. But anyhow, he didn't win. And actually, he had trouble on telly because the makeup woman told him that he had a head like a skull. And he said, "Doesn't everyone have a head like a skull?" But she said, "No, no." His head was peculiarly unsuitable for television. Which is probably true. But anyhow, he had beautiful manners, and in old age, he was on a train to Berwick, and two women came up to him, and they said, "We think it's a very great tragedy for this country that you were never Prime Minister." And Alec Hume said to them, "Well, as a matter of fact, I was, but only for a very short time."